Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
A long time ago, when I was a child, if you got away with murder, there was an enormous chance that you'd get away with murder if you were random. And you weren't actually cited by a witness because you know where you go. Most murders are stupid crimes performed by people who are either stupid or acting in haste, and therefore they tend to fall into them. They jump into the frying pan themselves. When they really think it through and are cunning, it's a bit harder.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Andrew Rule is one of Australia's best-known crime writers, admired by readers, police, peers, and criminals alike, for the most part. He's won every journalistic award Australia has to offer, the Graham Perkin Journalist of the Year Award twice, 8 Quills, 2 Walkleys, and the Ned Kelly Award for Lifetime Achievement in True Crime Writing. When a notorious Melbourne criminal, largely unknown in the rest of Australia, by the name of Mark Brandon Reed, aka Chopper Reed, decided to write his memoirs in the late 80s, it was Andrew Rule who started receiving packages from Pentridge of handwritten letters containing his tall stories. Andrew and his sometime collaborator, the equally legendary John Sylvester, fashioned those scraps of paper into several bestsellers, and the legend of Chopper was born. They went on to write Lead Belly about Melbourne's underworld, which inspired several Underbelly miniseries and launched the careers of a generation of Australian actors. Andrew's written dozens of books, not all of which are about crime. In fact, his latest is the authorised biography of Winx, the world's greatest racehorse. Emily and I are both massive fans of Andrew's and avid listeners to his podcast, Life and Crimes. Regular listeners of Australian True Crime will no doubt have noticed we name-check it often, and there's a link in the notes to this episode and on our social media pages. We uploaded an exclusive chat with Andrew about some of his most memorable cases to Patreon just before Christmas. So if you're not a patron yet, you can access that by going to patreon.com/austtruecrimepod, that's AUST, True Crime Pod, and becoming a $5 a month patron. Please be aware that's $5 US a month. Andrew Rule is an expert when it comes to Melbourne crime, particularly some of the city's most baffling unsolved cases. And this is one that really haunts our own Emily Webb because it occurred close to her childhood home and it involves the death of a young girl and her mum, Shauna and Margaret Tapp.
I know people through the community who actually went to school with Shauna. And in fact, my auntie used to live next door to Margaret and Shauna when they lived in Wantirna, and she remembers seeing Margaret zipping off in her car to work. I did some articles about these murders, and I actually spoke to a school friend of Shauna's. He's sadly since died, but he was extremely affected by her murder and remembers it as a really confusing time, and that parents didn't know how to explain what happened.
It's a dreadful crime, and it's one that's always intrigued me a lot because I felt that it was really badly investigated for whatever reason, or not well investigated. And one of the reasons is that police were busy with more and more homicides and they have to do the freshest ones. And in this case, there were so many potential leads.
It was a bit of a complicated investigation for police because Margaret was very sociable. She had a lot of friends.
She was a vivacious divorcee, as we used to say in those days, who knew a lot of guys. And any one of those guys could have been a suspect and any one of those guys' friends could have been suspects. So in the end, the police were swamped with potential leads, and none of them seemed much better or bigger than the others, apart from the persons closest to her, which were, the bloke that was going to pick her up that night, who's a harmless guy, but it took the police, probably 2 or 3 days to work that out, that he was harmless, and then maybe a brother-in-law or similar, that took them a couple of days to work out that he was harmless.
Because can you take us back to the beginning? Because I remember listening to this episode of your podcast. I was driving. I can still see where I was driving home from the airport, and I at one stage went, like that as I was driving.
Which bit was
I'm
that?
I'm not going to say it yet, but let you know when we get to it.
Right.
Because I thought to myself, because you're very brief in your podcast, that's the only criticism I have of them. They're not long enough. I want more. So I thought, I wonder if Andrew will come and talk to us more about the TABS. Can you please set it up for our listeners? Who were these people? What happened?
It's August 1984. The Los Angeles Olympics are on, so it's late winter. It's cold. We're in suburban Ferntree Gully, which in the 80s is sort of outer edge of Melbourne. They're in Kelvin Drive, I think it's called, which is a smallish residential street but close to the main road, so you could hear the traffic on the main road. They were at number 13, which meant they were only, say, 6 blocks from the main road. You know, it's not a really super-duper enviable address, but it was respectable suburbia. The house that Margaret lived in, she was divorced, had been for some time. She lived there with her teenage son and her daughter, Shauna, who was a little girl of 9 or 10. And on this occasion, on Tuesday, August the 7th, the son was staying with his grandparents in the country, and so Margaret is home alone with Shauna. Now, all we know is that next morning, the morning of the 8th, I think it is, the Wednesday morning, the girl next door, little girl next door, comes and knocks on the door to see if she can walk to school with Shauna, and she notices that the newspapers are lying in the drive, not picked up, the curtains are still down, no one answers the door. She thinks, oh, maybe they've slept in. So she walks to school. Later that day, a relative of Margaret's, I think her sister's fiancé or something, turns up and he notices the car's there, newspapers in the drive, same thing, curtains down, knocks on the door, no answer. He leaves. It's not until that evening that a friend, a male friend, who had arranged to come and take Margaret to the opera. And this is, say, 6 o'clock in the evening, mm-hmm. so it's after work. And this man's just a nice, friendly guy, and he used to like to go out with Margaret to the opera and things like that. And he turns up and knocks on the door, no answer. But he knows, because he's familiar with the place, that if you go around to the back door, you can get in because the back door had a dodgy lock. And he goes into that, knocks again, goes in. Basically, he finds Margaret dead in bed. And he finds Shauna dead in her bed. In both cases, I understand, despite the fact they've died violently, the bedclothes were pulled up around their necks very neatly. In fact, he at first hoped that they were asleep. To tell the truth, he didn't find Shauna for a few minutes because as soon as he found Margaret dead, he ran next door hoping Shauna was next door, hoping the little girl was still alive. And then when she wasn't next door, he came back and found her. So it was a heartbreaking, shocking thing for that man, and particularly because when the police turned up, naturally they grilled him because they thought he was a likely candidate, which statistically he is.
Yeah.
Statistically, most of us aren't killed by strangers or...
When you say the back door was dodgy, do you mean it was unlockable virtually?
Unlockable, had some problem, hadn't been fixed. Now, anybody that knew the house well, and that's more than one, would have known that. Margaret was obviously an intriguing and interesting woman in a lot of different ways. And this is not, I'm not using euphemisms here. She was clearly a very attractive personality. Men really liked her. She probably had a vivacious and strong, humorous personality. She was somebody that did stuff. She was learning to drive trucks and to get a truck license so she could go and help the brother of the man who owned the house, one of her lovers, to help him on his farm in South Australia. She was sort of interested in doing stuff. She'd roll her sleeves up and do stuff. She was studying law. She was a nurse, a theatre nurse, which is a highly skilled profession, but she was studying law at Monash.
Wow.
This is in the 80s. Not every, 30-something mother of...
Single mother.
Wow. ..is studying law because she could see that if she knew medicine and the law, she could become a bit of a specialist. Well, smart woman.
Gotcha.
But it made it hard for the police because everywhere Margaret went, men were sure to go. She knew guys from uni and she knew the guy that teaching her to drive the truck and she knew bloke down the road and she knew this doctor who owned the house, and that clouded the whole investigation for reasons we'll go into. We can go into now. And she worked at the William Anglis hospital up the road, up in the Dandenongs foothills, not far away. And there she knew many medical professionals and other professionals from the district. We'll be cagey about it. They weren't necessarily all doctors. She'd was known, and I've talked to one of her best friends who really loves her, or loved her, a woman who's told me that Margaret was her best friend and she still misses her and she really liked her. But she said she was, you know, she had a lot of blokes. She had relationships with half a dozen of the people at the William Angelus, which is interesting because any one of those could be a suspect, but you'd wonder whether they were all really cleared properly. And one of them was an anaesthetist that I've spoken to, who is a person probably known to you, or you'd know his family, who still speaks with great wistfulness and affection about Margaret. She had this effect on people that those who knew her really liked her.
She must have been a force of nature.
She was, I think. That's the right phrase.
Andrew, to find the time to be dating men while she's also a nurse, got two kids studying law. I mean, I don't know how she had the time.
I agree. She was obviously one of those.
Wow, no wonder people were attracted to her.
Highly, yeah. She was turbocharged. Yes. You know, she had highly intelligent, probably had she been born in a different time and place, in a different family. She was born in a very conservative family, so perhaps the way she was a reaction against that. Yeah. And I think probably the nature of her family, her own family, the Nelson family, meant that she was always rebelling against that. And I know that she'd run away from home as a teenager, and I know that a family friend, allegedly a policeman, had gone and found her in St Kilda somewhere and so on and so on. So she was always a bit of a rebel. And I'd say very smart. I've met her older sister and I've spoken to her nieces and I've spoken to her brother. And it's clear to me that, you know, they're a smart family but not necessarily a happy one.
So where on earth do we start investigating this? You door knock the neighbourhood and then you've also got men in the workplaces at uni. There's just so many people to talk to.
Well, I first came to this story way back around the turn of this century when I was in Perth on another story and I re-met an older journalist over there called Rex Hoare, who was a former Victorian, and he ended up being a senior police reporter in Perth and then he went and worked for the police force as a communications guy. And I knew Rex and he was a good guy. And he was married to a woman whose sister was married to a serving detective in Victoria. So he was an insider in many respects. And he said to me, apropos of nothing, because I was there doing a bikey story, he said, mate, you should look at this tap car. I said, what's that? He said, you know, the woman and daughter that was killed back in 84. And I said, oh, yeah, I vaguely remember it. He said, it really is very odd and strange because someone I'm related to, and he met his brother-in-law, seems to think that there was an ex-policeman written out of the case who might have known more about it than he should have. And he was allowed back on the murder scene when he shouldn't have been to collect a book or something that would connect him with her, Margaret, and probably something he didn't want to come out at inquest because it might be embarrassing that he'd been dropping around to see her or whatever. Now, there's a suspicion, a sliver of suspicion that this ex-policeman, whose name we know, he's now dead, so we can talk about him, that he might have been a good suspect for it. And I worked on that basis for a long time, that this guy was a really good suspect who I believed had never really been looked at properly. And I went to the homicide squad and I found ex-homicide guys and I could never really get a straight answer that satisfied me about who'd been properly exonerated later on by DNA. Because what we haven't said yet, and we have to, is that Shauna Tapp had been sexually molested in some way and there was body fluids, a male body fluid found on her nightclothes or on her.
Mm-hmm.
So the police at that
and
stage...
And Margaret hadn't?
I don't believe so.
Wow.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Now, so the only clues from the house are Shauna, the little girl, has been the target of some sort of sexual deviant attack. So we're looking at a sort of pedophile thing. And the other thing that has never been cleared up was that the footprints in the house were of volley sand shoes. Now, remember the old Ripple
Dunlop volleys?
Dunlop volleys.
Yes.
We all knew about them. Everybody had them. they were never able to work out who had the Dunlop volleys. It's clear that if you find the wearer of the Dunlop volleys, you've probably found the killer.
Mm. But you couldn't find out from police who had been exonerated by DNA.
It was tricky. Mm. And you know what? Even I think the story I wrote in about 2001 or two prompted the police to go and do more, you know, with old cases. You can't blame them. They've got a lot of old cases.
Yeah, because why is one old case? Cold case squad, didn't
no,
we?
No, not really. Not waxes and wanes, you know. They were interested in it for a while, then they've got to worry about, you know, the murder that happened yesterday rather than one that happened 25 years ago. You know, this is nature. This is how it goes. Mm. One thing that fascinated me was that Margaret's own brother, a bloke called Lindsay Nelson, I found him, ex-army guy, probably not altogether a happy camper. You know, like a lot of ex-soldiers, he was a bit lost perhaps.
And like members of Margaret's family by the sounds of things.
Yeah, he was, may not have got on with his parents that well or something. But he said to me that he had never been exonerated himself, which surprised him that he should have been. Now, he obviously knew where they lived.
Mm.
He had carted furniture to the house for her and he'd gone there with other guys, I think from a local council, let's say, that he might have worked at the local council or something, and he'd gone around there with a truck that they'd borrowed from work and they carted furniture for Margaret, a table and stuff. And he nominated to me different guys he worked with, including one guy who was interesting because he owned a red Falcon ute with certain sort of mag wheels, and that a vehicle of that description had been seen in the street on the day that Margaret was murdered.
So Lindsay's making the point then that he feels that police haven't gone through the DNA stuff enough.
Yeah, he wasn't aggro about it, but on questioning from me, he conceded that, yes, that's true. Now, him and the other guys he knew that he worked with who'd been there in the truck, now, these are not bad. They're people that should be eliminated. I would suggest that every man at the Angus Hospital should have been properly eliminated and not just where were you on the 7th of August. Oh, I was... You know, I was here at work, then I went home. You know, I mean, I suspect that with doctors, police would be fairly respectful and probably not probe their alibis too hard because, of course, you're dealing with, you know, a dozen people at a time. Mm-hmm. They can't all have done it and probably none of them have done it. So you're not going to be too rigorous or robust. You're dealing with people that could make your life hard if you make theirs hard. You know, in the 80s, flatfoot coppers dealing with people that would sort of rank them financially, intellectually and socially. You know, it's a tricky thing, isn't it? Down the street is a teenage boy who's part of a fairly dysfunctional family. This boy was, he worried a lot of the neighbours because he would ride up and down the street and he'd say, he was just a little bit different and he would say weird things, inappropriate things to women. And Margaret being Margaret, force of nature and generous and kind, she would pay him, you know, $2 or whatever to mow the lawn and to wash her car and all that. Now, he would have known how to get into the back door, this guy. Now, I've tracked this guy down in 2002. He's working at a motor wreckers. He's pulling parts off cars and putting them on the shelf. You know, he's one of those guys. He's a grease monkey. And I found this guy, and he is a bit different and he is a bit strange, and his family were dysfunctional and a large family. And he told me, yeah, Margaret, I really like Margaret. You know, she was really good to me. Have you been to see her grave? I said, no. And he said, oh, she's buried at such and such a cemetery. Mm-hmm. And you walk through the gate and then you go down and you turn left and you go along and it's a brown speckly. He knew the headstone off backwards. He knew all about it, an interest in her. He also mentioned to me that she'd been strangled with an iron cord or electrical cord. Now, whether that she was or not, I don't know. But he volunteered that. Whether that had been speculation or one of the police had said it at the time, who knows?
That was the moment in my car when you said that. I went, why is he saying that all these years later?
All these years later. Now, it could be that in the street that week, you know, or everybody be talking about it for weeks and weeks and weeks, somebody could have just raised that as a possibility, or one of the coppers might have said it. You know, who knows? But that family, I tracked down his brothers, who are knockabout fellows. Dad was an interstate truck driver. You know, they were the rough rented house in the street, okay? The brothers, one of them said to me, yeah, he said, I was never cleared. He said, I was working at Bowater Scott on night shift, the paper factory, whatever it was, and I've come home at midnight. He said, it could be me. I'm a perfect candidate for this. Why wasn't I cleared? You know, he put his hand up. Then his sister was living with, or her boyfriend anyway, was living in a caravan at their house. This is, you know, 60 metres from Margaret's. The boyfriend's living in a caravan, backed up the rented house of the truckie and the big family. And he later, I found out, I've got his name, he later did time in Pentridge for a sex crime, for a rape or something. Now, you've got a whole swag of people who all were potential candidates and say it themselves. Why wasn't I cleared? I lived there. I was the right age.
And you've got DNA.
And you've got DNA. The DNA's there, but later on the technology gets better. At the time what you've got is a sample, which...
But if it still exists now...
Yes, well, there's an interesting point. Oh. Michelle, I'm glad you brought that up, because does it exist now in a form that would work in court? Rhetorical question. I believe not. I believe there'd probably be a sample, but you may recall just a few years ago, maybe recently, like 7 years ago, moderately recently, there was a fairly big story in the Melbourne media saying police have breakthrough in 1984 case. Police are going to jail at Sale, you know, the one up there, to, it's no longer called Sale Jail, but that's the replacement, to interview a prisoner, I suspect a sex offender, about this because they've got a match with DNA. So the DNA from Shauna allegedly matched this prisoner's DNA. It looks so good that a detective leaked it to one of his favourite reporters, and it made a pretty good story, which it would. You can't blame anybody for this. But sadly, when they get our mate out of jail, it's a guy called Russell Geeser. Russell Geeser is, I think, a Thursday Islander, or he's from islands well up to the north of Victoria, like, you know. He would have grown up closer to New Guinea than to Victoria. It turns out that poor old Russell, when you go through his history, it turns out that he was not in Victoria at the time, and possibly provably so. He might have been, you know, in jail in Townsville or something. And Russell's not it at all. Yeah. So what that tells you is that the DNA has been compromised at the lab. They've screwed up the tests and they've jumbled up the DNA sample or something. Now, this means legally, if not scientifically, that any attempt to prosecute somebody using that sample from now on, you'd think would be doomed to failure, because a lawyer's going to get up and say, well, they screwed this up. God knows whose it is. It could be the postman's. It could be anybody. Who knows what's happened at the lab, the forensics, and it's just a mess. So I hope there's enough left that they could actually screen people for their own detective purposes.
Yes.
And then talk to those people at length about their movements. But I doubt whether that sample is ever going to be used successfully to prosecute a suspect in this case.
After the break, Andrew Rule tells us about the man he has always suspected of the murder of Margaret and Shauna Tapp. Coming up, we discuss a tip-off we passed on to Andrew from an Australian true crime listener. It's a piece of information Andrew took seriously enough to pass on to police. But first, the man he has always suspected.
Well, I was always keen on the old ex-copper that dropped in.
Still, okay.
No, I was. I've changed my mind. Mm-hmm. I was very keen on him. And in fact, I drove once to Painesville to knock on his door.
Did you?
Yes, I did. Well, I had to go up and I went there. No, he was away on a cruise. He was a very bad amateur painter, an artiste, and he did terrible paintings. And one of them I'd seen, he'd done a painting of Shauna as a little girl with a campfire in the bush and given it to her grandparents as sort of a gift. Shauna's uncle, Margaret's brother, sent me a copy of it and said, you know, he thought it was creepy. But whether it was creepy or not, you know, it's hard to know. Maybe it's just a misplaced, you know.
Because this bloke at the very least was one of Margaret's boyfriends,
well,
do you think?
Well, clearly he used to hang around. Mind you, he was a guy that was much older. He was somebody that knew her father.
Oh.
So he's younger than her father but older than Margaret. So he was the creepy uncle type. And I don't know that Margaret went for him at all, because she said to her sister, who's a fine woman and a great witness, the sister said to me that she told the police about this guy. Immediately that day she said Margaret didn't like him coming here and she thought he was creepy and spooky, and she told the police hot and strong. Now, whether they went easy on him is an interesting question, because he was a Mason, and this will be a word that won't mean much to you or your audience.
It does to me, because my granddad was a Mason.
Yes, so, mine too. The Masons were a very powerful underlying force back in that era, particularly in things like the police force. The police force was the last flowering of that sort of Masonic brotherhood. So you had whole squads that were dominated by Masons and whole squads dominated by the Catholics.
Yes.
And they hated each other.
That's right.
And they worked against each other.
The commissioner was, wasn't
You're right.
it?
That's exactly
who
right.
was favoured at the time.
And you'll recall all this stuff about child molesting in Mildura and so on. Mm. The sort of Catholic ascendancy meant the priests didn't get investigated the way they should have.
Yes.
Because certain, and this is not all, but certain senior police would put their finger on it, even if other detectives wanted to do a proper job. So let's not smear everybody with this. But the man we're talking about was a Mason. Some of the investigating police, and at least one, will have been a Mason. And Margaret's old father, Mr. Nelson, was a Mason. Now, it might be one of the reasons that this never got a lot of publicity at the time. The family were hugely embarrassed. Their daughter and their granddaughter is dead. They can't bring them back. You're not going to solve it. You're not going to bring them back. So it's a tragedy. On top of tragedy, from their point of view, maybe they didn't want, you know, her whole private life dragged through the media, through the coroner's court.
Yes, I never thought of it that
way. Because it would be on top of the tragedy.
I was just going to ask you why there's never been an inquest, but yes, okay.
Well, they didn't want – you can understand why some people wouldn't want – in those days, and you've got to remember it's a different era.
It's hard to understand
It's hard to understand now, but in the 80s, with people who were then – already quite old, grandparents, why would they want their totally traumatised grandson, who's 14 years old, Justin, the oldest son of Margaret, to be exposed to all this stuff?
So an inquest where every day another man comes through to say, yes, I was sleeping with Margaret.
Exactly.
Yes, I was sleeping with Margaret.
And in the end, they can see that, and I'm just sort of riffing here. I don't really know what they thought, but I can guess that would be part of the way they thought. The other part of the Masonic link in my mind, and I'm making this up, right, is that if the ex-copper who's a Mason wants to come in and remove a book that he's lent Margaret,
so when did he come in and do
letters,
that, by the way, when it was still a crime scene?
Yeah. Early doors.
He just can't arrive.
I understand so. And now I can't prove that. I was told that by people. I think Margaret's sister became aware of it. I was told that initially that he'd been
that he arrived
scene.
And said, "Hey, can I pop in and grab a book that I've loaned her?
A book or letters, or he might have said a book, but it was letters or whatever." Mm. Now, if that's the case, and I don't see why anyone would make it up, it is interesting, but not necessarily, you know, incriminating.
It's not a smoking gun.
The other thing is, at the funeral, there's funeral cars for the family, the grieving relatives, who are really upset, of course. This guy, the sort of pseudo family friend, he insists on getting in one of the funeral cars with the family and sort of forcing himself in there and being all grief-stricken. And that struck Margaret's sister, who's, as I say, really sensible and really sane and really intelligent. It struck her as weird and inappropriate. So I always wondered about that. I always wondered whether he and or any relatives of his were connected in some way with, say, Brownie's guides, and whether Shauna had been mixed up in was, I think, a member of the local Brownie, and whether that was a connection. I've never had any luck with the organisation. As soon as reporters come looking, they don't want to talk to you for good reasons. So there's all these – the point I guess we're making is there are a dozen interesting leads, and that was the one I was always keen on until this year when your program contacted me and said, guess what, we've had a call from the son of a former professional person who used to live in the Dandenongs who's – might have known Margaret Tapp. Now, as you know, but our listeners don't know altogether anyway, the person that contacted was the son of this professional, and he said his father, through his profession, probably knew Margaret Tapp well, and his father, from whom he's estranged for good reason, his father, although a popular, athletic, good-looking, you know, sort of man about town in the Dandenongs, he was at home a secret monster. He molested a whole series of young girls from the age of four up to, you know, teenagers. And I knew this to be the case when I talked to this young guy, because it turns out that one of his victims, alleged victims, was a friend of my daughter's. And I've always known about this guy, because he was eventually convicted of one case. Now, he had molested dozens of kids. There were, I think, seven brought up against him, and they tried each one of them separately, and he had a gun QC representing, as happens. He went down on only one, but he certainly did a lot more than that. His professional association went through him. They ended up acknowledging there was at least eight victims, and that he'd offended for 20-plus years, from the 70s until the 90s. And he was a charming, good-looking, narcissistic fellow who was well thought of by some people. He was a social butterfly, financially successful, in an era when people, you needed money to sort of go on annual skiing trips and overseas trips and to buy, you know, European cars. Back in the 80s, not everybody could do that. Well, he did. You know, he had that sort of lifestyle. And after he was exposed, his wife changed her name and left him, married someone else. His three children, one of them is the one that contacted you and then me, and the other two, I understand, are very sad cases. They've gone from being, you know, reasonably high-achieving children. I think two of them are serious drug addicts because what they're exposed to as kids. Now, he used to prey on his daughter's little friends. I mean, this guy used his own daughter as bait, essentially. So he is a complete reptile. He's still alive. And regardless of any accusations about Margaret Tapp, which we'll go into in a minute, he is a reptile. Mm-hmm. He is still alive. He's no longer practicing his profession. And he lives in a border town near the Murray River, where he probably plays golf. Could he be the man who killed Margaret Tapp and Shauna? Well, he undoubtedly knew them, or knew Margaret. He had access to Margaret. He was undoubtedly the type of man, given that Margaret had had affairs with several professional men, undoubtedly he would fit that category. He'd be at the top of it. He lived not far up the hills from Ferntree Gully. He played tennis every week in a winter comp with his friends, one of whom I know, and they played on the courts with the red dust. And guess what? They played on Tuesday nights in 1984. The murder was on Tuesday night. It was obviously later in the evening. You know, it wasn't at dinner time, we wouldn't think. It would be later in the evening. Mm. And he used to wear volley sand shoes to play
tennis.
Everyone
wore Dunlop volleys to play tennis.
In my view, he's got to be the best suspect. I mean, it doesn't prove he did it, but you've got to eliminate that guy. Because this was always a sex crime. Yes. At some level, it was a sex crime. This man has been convicted of sex crimes against young girls. That, we know, is it down a bit. He's the sort of man that could easily have had an affair with Margaret or been attracted to her or vice versa. He wore Dunlop volleys, size 11 as it turns out, according to his son. And he used to play tennis in the evenings on Tuesdays at that time, that winter he did. And he was 5-8 minutes drive away. He just is the first one you need to eliminate.
So did you then take the information to homicide detectives? What do you do with that? When someone rings you with a tip like that and you investigate it to a certain degree and go, wow.
I did, of course. I passed it straight on because, you know, sometimes we come across stuff that we pass on.
I bet a lot of people come to you with stuff.
And sometimes I think, you know, this year there's been a couple of cases where I think the information is potentially hot stuff. Mm. Now, even if it is hot stuff, it's another quite another thing to prove it. It's easy for us to write stories and do podcasts.
Yeah.
And not so easy to be homicide or cold case guys who've got to come up with a watertight legal case against someone. That's a different kettle of fish. Mm. But in two cases this year, including this one, I think the information that's come up, that's bubbled up, is, you know, very interesting.
Really?
Hmm.
Wow, that's amazing. Why do you think it is that cold cases seem to be being solved more commonly?
Science.
Yeah?
I just think, look, you know, if you did a crime, if one did a crime in the, up until, say, 1990s, I'm going to say, nearly, and particularly earlier, 70s, 80s, very few closed-circuit televisions around, those cameras. There wasn't one on every street corner and every shop and every premises. We're now surrounded by them. We now all use credit cards all the time.
Mm.
You know, down in our canteen here, they buy a $3 coffee with a credit card.
Right, we're so traceable. Phone pings.
And then the phone
pings.
Yes,
yes.
Social media.
Social media and phones, these things, and I'm holding up here a smartphone, is one of the best ways.
Device.
It's a tracking device.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the tragic Jill Marr case, if that had happened, which it easily could have, you know, a similar crime, in even, let's say, the turn of the century, like the year 2000, there's a fair chance that guy doesn't get caught because he doesn't know her, so he's a stranger, random person. I suspect that he wouldn't be carrying a phone that's going to ping off the things at that era. And
he's very highly skilled. He's there Monday morning changing over the boot mat, changing the tyres.
All that stuff.
He knows how to do all that.
All that stuff. He's a practiced criminal in that sense. He's got away with stuff before.
Yeah.
And there won't be the same surveillance stuff up the highways. Now, when they really want to look for you now, they can. They're not going to come around and solve your burglary using high-tech stuff.
I tell you what amazed me was the Eurydice Dixon case when the police so quickly had an image of that man getting out of the train station, Flinders Street, was it, or Southern Cross Station? That's quite a distance from the park where Eurydice was found. I cannot fathom how police realised to look there for him so quickly. And
There's things we don't know,
like
there's other footage that puts him in there.
Yes.
So they work backwards and go, where'd this guy come from?
Absolutely.
And footage there. I mean, we've all watched the crime shows out of England. Where there's people sitting there with banks of cameras going, here's one, here he is, he moved there, he went there.
And they can follow them all the way home.
And you know, that's reality. There's people sitting in buildings here in Melbourne, you know, the city council, and looking for the traffic jams, whatever. Mm. And once they really want to trace you, I think it's pretty hard not to be traced. Mm. Now, that wasn't true as recently as 15, 20 years ago. Mm. Not as true. And a long time ago, when I was a child, it wasn't true at all. If you got away with murder, there was an enormous chance that you'd get away with murder if you were random and you weren't actually cited by a witness, because, you know, away you go, unless you did something reasonably.
Yeah, you're right.
A lot of murders are stupid. Most murders are stupid crimes performed by people who are either stupid or acting in haste, and therefore they tend to fall into them. They jump into the frying pan themselves. When they really think it through and cunning, it's a bit harder. I arranged through Justin's aunt, Margaret's big sister, I said, I'm going to England on other business, but I want to talk to Justin. And that's where he went. Justin actually had a UK passport because his father was English or whatever. And although he grew up in Melbourne and played cricket out in the suburbs, he did have dual passports. He might have literally been born in England, actually. Margaret and the kid's father, I think, might have lived there for a couple of years. Anyway, so he can go to England and get away from all this as a grown man. So he goes over there and he works in maybe IT or something, and he plays cricket in a big sort of provincial town, High Wycombe, I think it is. And by the time I got to England and to find him, he was dead. It turned out he was dead. And I went to the High Wycombe and I found his former partner and her daughters, who was a really friendly, lovely woman. She picked me up at the station and we had lunch and all this. And they were quite heartbroken about it and said, look, we'd split up because he just was destroying himself with drinking because he lived with this monstrous thing of his – mother and sister being murdered when he was 14, a 14-year-old boy, and he was always tortured with the idea had he been home, he would have stopped it.
Yeah.
So it's a very male thing that you just can't get over it because you think you could have stopped it and you let him down. And he nursed that for 25 years or whatever it was. And he ends up dying alone in this rented room in High Wycombe. Nobody found him till they smelt him. He was so decomposed that they had to do a DNA test to prove it was him. It was just awful. And so really the murderer killed him as well. I think your candidate, the one you came up with, is, it seems to me, by far the best candidate because he fits every – I mean, the volley Sanchez, how good was that? I've always been keen on this story. Amazing thing about it, when this guy in Western Australia said, you should look at it, I went back to the 80s files and I went through and I'd been a police reporter at the time, right? And I vaguely remembered it. And I thought, this is amazing. There were five little stories on a page, five stories stuck down on one page in our old files. And I thought, what is this? And I sort of thought things like, you know, were the police trying to keep it quiet or what? But I actually, to be fair, I think it's because the family didn't want to come out and do the big PR thing and be photographed and talk about it because they were thunderstruck with grief. And they could see, known undoubtedly, that there'd be a lot of negative publicity and they're sort of ashamed as well as...
That makes a lot of sense to me.
I think
growing up in Toowoomba with Masons...
You'd understand.
Totally. That they
you get it.
I think they'd have thought the same thing.
And you'd understand, you know, country towns.
Yes.
You get that in your DNA, you get it.
You do, yeah.
And you just understand the way things are. There's a sort of shameful thing.
And as you say, it's not going to bring them back. And I can almost hear them having that conversation. Of course. Why would we go through all of that?
Because it doesn't bring them back.
At the end of it, we're not going to get them back.
It doesn't.
No.
And unless you go in for the sort of vengeance thing, which some people do, it gives them something to focus on. They want to focus on something. Well, Lee's family didn't. And God bless them. I'm not judging them at all.
No, we definitely find that on the show. There's a few sort of tracks, isn't it, that people tend to take, vengeance or the...
Obsession.
The obsession.
The build shrines.
The foundation. Yeah. The never coping. The kind of drink yourself to death.
Drink yourself to death.
40 years later in a room.
Yeah. So it is a tragic story. Of course, all murders are. But I felt that the media a little bit and the police a little bit more let down Margaret Tapp. And I'm not saying that it was a deliberate sort of slut-shaming, judgmental thing. Mm. I mean, it's probably a temptation for some people to say that. I think that's probably a little bit unfair, to be fair, to the people back then. I think they were busy. They had other stuff to do, which was just as urgent, just as tragic. And there were so many potential leads, all of the same height. None of them much good, but none much better than the other. Now, it's all very well for us to talk about the professional guy whose son's come forward now, but nobody came forward then. So the police didn't have a red-hot candidate. They just had a hell of a lot of people that they needed to tick off.
And you're right, probably three or four days later, another murder on their desk.
They did.
And then another one and then another one and solvable.
They did. And they had to solve the ones they had to solve.
And you know, the son who came forward, he actually had not really heard of this case. He was watching that television show Million Dollar Cold Case.
Yeah.
That's how he was like, oh, and then he just started putting some connections together about his father
and
the area, and that's kind of what got his head turning. He hadn't even heard of the case until 2016 or 17. So.
Because we kept pushing it. You know, basically it was never written about until I started
revived it.
The first story was, say, 2002. Then I did a big anniversary piece a few years later in a national magazine on the 20th anniversary of the crime. And then I did other anniversary pieces and this other piece recently. So, but the last one is spawned by that because the TV people will have seen those stories that I did in the Herald Sun on the file and then they've said we should do this one.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime, and thank you so much to our patrons who've made it possible for us to conduct our first free listener events recently. We were treated to walking tours around Pentridge Prison with former prison guard Vaughan Ruddick. We'll share some highlights from that tour on Patreon soon, We'll be organising more events around Australia, and we'll have a brand new episode of Australian True Crime starring Vaughn in a couple of weeks. I hope you can join us for that.